It would have been good for you to be here, George, so you could see what America really looks like.
Talking about a terrorist group is a group that performs acts of terrorism. To provoke them into action is to provoke them into committing acts of terrorism.
I would like to know where the Department of Defense gets the statutory authorization for the Total Awareness Program.
The problem with nonviolence is that it doesn't take evil seriously. I think there's a difference between nonviolent theory and practice and pacifism.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, November 27th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush created an independent commission today to investigate the September 11th terrorist attacks. He named former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to lead the panel, citing Kissinger's, quote, broad experience, clear thinking, and careful judgment, unquote. The commission is expected to investigate issues such as border problems, aviation security, and the tactics and motives of the enemy. But it will not look into the failure of the government to prevent the terrorist attacks, nor will it delve deeply into American ally Saudi Arabia's alleged role in supporting the al-Qaeda terrorist network. Meanwhile, a rather damning report came out a few weeks ago, buried deep within the Los Angeles Times Sunday edition. Submerged by mounds of gray newsprint and glossy underwear ads, writes Counterpunch columnist Chris Floyd, was an article referring to the Department of Defense's plan to create a new organization that will stimulate reactions among terrorist groups, provoking them into committing violent acts and exposing them to counterattack by U.S. forces. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with him earlier today.
It was originally sparked by the William Arkin article in the Los Angeles Times. He had a long article detailing all of the covert military capabilities that are being gathered under Rumsfeld's umbrella. And one of them was called the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, P2OG, which we refer to as P2, to carry out secret missions to stimulate reactions from terrorist groups, which to me seems like a very stupid policy, actually. I mean, we're talking about a terrorist group is a group that performs acts of terrorism. To provoke them into action is to provoke them into committing acts of terrorism. The ostensible goal of this, of course, is to flush them out of the open, and then you can attack them with your more overt military capabilities, I suppose. But again, it's sort of a harebrained scheme. It's just the old burn down a village in order to save it. I mean, you're going to cause terrorism in order to prevent terrorism. It doesn't make much sense.
Well, what types of actions do you foresee the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group taking part in to provoke terrorism?
Well, I don't know. This is what this is what is all up in there. We don't know. As I say in the article, how are they going to spark terrorists into action? Are they going to kill their family members? Are they going to lure them into it with loot? Are they going to give them drugs? Are they going to, stir them up with some jihad propaganda? Are they going to infiltrate these groups and actually plan and direct attacks themselves? The point then is that they can then take these measures, and not only against terrorist groups, but also the P2 plan goes on to say that they can take measures against the states or the sub-state actors who are accountable for harboring these gangs. Again, it doesn't spell out what kind of measures. It only says that these states, their sovereignty will be at risk. And a program that will come in handy whenever the Bush people want to launch some sort of overt military action. They want to get a little, real estate with oil in it or a new military base. They can just find four malcontents. You infiltrate them. You stir them up to blow up a building somewhere, and then suddenly you can send your military into that failed state, and take over their sovereignty and flush out the terrorists. Or you can do any sort of thing. The capability to do anything is there. And we know from the past history of the last 50 years of the history of American covert operations that they use these capabilities for all kinds of nefarious means, I suppose, nefarious ways.
Is there any sort of historical precedent for this sort of thing?
I suppose there's a whole number of precedents. One thing that I mentioned in the article is called Operation Northwoods. Well, I've talked about it before. It was a plan that the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented to John Kennedy in 1963. It was a plan, it was a carefully laid out plan. It was calling for a phony terrorist campaign. They were going to have bombings, they were hijackings, they were going to have plane crashes, they were going to have deaths. It says in their planning, either real deaths or fake deaths. Either way, they didn't care. And they were going to use all this to provide just, they were going to blame it on Cuba and use it as a justification for invading Cuba. This was very carefully laid out. It wasn't laid out by so-called rogue operators like Oliver North, who, of course, was actually operating with top approval. But it was laid out by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This was the very top of the U.S. military. This is the plan they presented. Kennedy turned it down, but this is a mindset that's been operating at the top levels of the American government for 50 years. I suppose it grows out of World War II when you have this desperate struggle against these evil forces and where you think that, you know, any means is justified toward the end, and they just carried that over. I'm trying to give them credit, you know, trying to say what reason why they might be doing this.
And, of course, there's other historical events when provocations have actually resulted in wars, such as, I guess, the Gulf of Tonkin incident would be the one that most people would think of.
Well, absolutely. Yes, that Northwoods is a particularly big example. Of course, it didn't happen, as you say. Yes, they have the Gulf of Tonkin. It goes all the way back to sinking the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor down in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. So, and it goes in history. I mean, it's not a uniquely American trait to use these provocations to provoke some action that that you want to have happen. So, in some ways, the column is not really news, but it's just news into how it's being. It's a new form of this sort of transmutation. As I say in the column, Kennedy rejected the Northwoods, but now Rumsfeld has sort of resurrected this plan. But it's on a far grander scale. He has far more resources at his disposal than the guys did back in 1963, and he has no counterbalancing global rival to restrain him. And there's one reason why I'm sure Kennedy got rid of the plan, besides its moral heinousness and its stupidity, was that it could provoke a whole entire world war, nuclear war. But there's no one out there now at this point that would block this sort of thing. There's no global superpower rival to restrain us. And so, and as I say, we've got a president who's shown himself eager to embrace any means whatsoever to advance the interests of this ruling clique, these elitists that he surrounds himself with that are controlling the country now, basically. So it seems a pretty dicey situation to me.
Chris Floyd is a columnist for the Moscow Times and a regular contributor to Counterpunch.org. He spoke with producer Scott Gurian. Earlier today, we spoke with Greg Palast, an investigative reporter for the BBC and author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We talked to Palast about what appeared to some to be inconsistencies on the part of the Bush administration in its fight against terrorism.
I'm a reporter for BBC Television, and we broke the story at the top of the news in Britain last year that FBI agents, CIA agents, and others had given us information, including documents, showing that the Bush administration had prevented our intelligence agencies from tracking down Saudi Arabian money links to terrorist organizations, and that includes Al-Qaeda.
Now, that means you're referring to the senior Bush administration.
No. This Bush administration walked in. On the other hand, while Bill Clinton was very nervous about investigating Saudi Arabian connections to terrorism, the Bush administration put a clamp, an absolute clamp, on investigations. There were several investigations which were named to us, which were shut down, including we had documents showing that there was a shutdown of the investigation of American members of the bin Laden family.
So George W. walked into office and put a halt to any of the investigations that the CIA and FBI were conducting. Do I smell an oil well here?
Well, yeah, follow the money, of course. I mean, you have to understand the Bush family and the Saudi Arabians go way back politically and financially. I mean, you have to remember that George W. became very rich as an oil man, though he had this knack for drilling nothing but dry holes in the desert. But he was hit some gushers by drilling into the pockets of Saudi financial interests. He had a company, Spectrum 7, that almost went bust. Arbusto was another company. I mean, shrub in Spanish. Arbusto Oil, another one of George W.'s failed companies. And then finally, these were absorbed by Harkin Oil. All these companies, including Harkin, had their ashes pulled out of the fire by investments from the Gulf states. Now, again, they weren't successful at finding oil, but very successful at getting investments from the Gulf. This created some type of disposition,
mm-hmm.
I believe, towards going light on the Saudi Arabians.
Bush is setting up an independent commission to investigate the 9/11 attacks headed by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, of all people. Yet there's been no investigation into the possible Saudi Arabian links to the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center. And I believe there are 14 of whom were...
15 of the 19.
15 of the
19. Were Saudi.
Yes.
And now, first of all, it's a little bit late to begin with, and Henry Kissinger, who has tremendous links to the Saudis financially, to be asked to investigate his clients, in effect, I guess that's what you would expect when you have both houses of Congress and the White House in the hands of one party. In fact, there was an investigation called for earlier by one Congresswoman, Cynthia McKinney, who cited my reports for BBC Television and The Guardian and other reports linking Saudi Arabian money to terrorist organizations, calling for an investigation of why the investigation of those links, and second, why those links weren't looked at before. At that point, the campaign of slander and libel began against her, saying that she had said that Bush knew about... The reason she's raising is she's claiming that Bush knew about September 11th attacks in advance. She never said such a thing. But that's what happens to people who raise these questions. And so now, imagine, we're talking about now investigating the September 11th, 2001 attack. It's almost 2003.
Well, tell us more about the links that you say Henry Kissinger has to the Saudi oil.
In a story, actually, that won an award, the type of award you don't want to get, from the University... California State University Project Censored. And there was an award, a story that wasn't broadcast in the U.S., but on BBC and in the Guardian newspapers of London. We said that there was a meeting held in 1996 in Paris between the financial arm of Al-Qaeda and some of the top members of the Saudi royal family and other Saudi billionaires and some arms dealers to discuss how much each of the Saudi billionaires would give to Al-Qaeda. Now, understand, this is not necessarily because the Saudis are in love with Al-Qaeda. It had as much to do with Al-Qaeda's implicit threat that if their brethren with the big bucks in Saudi Arabia didn't come across, their yachts in the Mediterranean would be blown up. And in fact, it is understood, believed by U.S. intelligence agencies, that the Khobar Towers attack was kind of a delinquency notice for slow payment to Al-Qaeda.
Now, where are those towers located?
And the Khobar Towers were in Saudi Arabia. They were where U.S. servicemen were housed. 19 Americans were killed when a truck bomb exploded in front of those towers.
So it would be fair to say that the Saudis, if they are proven to have been giving money to the terrorists, it was blackmailed being blackmailed by the terrorists.
It may have been blackmailed. It's a little bit different culture, and my understanding is that it's a combination of blackmail, but yet understanding with a bit of kind of sympathy for Al-Qaeda, if not their methods. But they remember, Al-Qaeda wants to overthrow the Saudi Arabian royalty, so it's mostly a threat. But there are others who give because they believe in it. The thing is that we've known this for years. The Clinton administration knew this and tried to keep a bit of a lid on it, but they would never confront the Saudis. We had, for example, a Saudi Arabian diplomat who sought political asylum in the U.S. During the Clinton administration. He came across with 14,000 pages of documentation out of the Saudi Arabian embassy, showing that the Saudis were involved in, for example, funding Saddam Hussein's nuclear arms program.
Greg Palast is an investigative journalist speaking with us from his office in New York. You can read his articles and reports at gregpalast.com. International arms inspectors said today that they have begun their work searching Iraq for weapons of mass destruction. However, many people in Iraq are not optimistic that the presence of inspectors will avert war. Eric Edgen is a member of the Chicago-based peace group Voices in the Wilderness, and he recently served as a member of the Iraq Peace Team. The peace team sends international volunteers to live amongst the Iraqi people as they brace for an increased bombing campaign. Eric spoke with Matthew Bradley of the D.C. Independent Media Center about his journey.
I started getting involved with the sanctions, or trying to end the sanctions, about 4 years ago. Started reading into it a lot. And I've been reading into it for years, and then really got involved with it this year. And I planned a solidarity fast It was 4 days in solidarity with the 40-day fast that was held in New York City in front of the United Nations. I heard about the Iraq Peace Team and was one of the people selected to go. The hardest part was when I left Indianapolis, my first plane that I took off on had to land back at the airport because of a landing gear failure. But I finally ended up on a plane to LaGuardia and then had to go from there to JFK. In the whole course of changing planes, my luggage didn't get transferred. Flew from JFK to Amman, Jordan, and was there for 2 days. It took 9 hours to get from Amman, Jordan to Baghdad, and a half hour at the border. We got through very fast. Most other groups took 3 hours or so. My luggage came like a week later. Even though it's against the sanctions for us to be in Iraq, my luggage made it all the way from Indianapolis Airport to Saddam Airport in Baghdad. When I got there, there were approximately 12 people, and there was also a Christian Peacemaker Team delegation that came that was part of Voices, or part of the Iraq Peace Team, which brought the numbers up to 30. A lot of the people that went were older, in their 70s. They were saying, well, we're older, we have the experience, and we've been through wars, and we don't want to see another war. The main things we did was, for the people who hadn't been to Iraq, we went to hospitals and schools, and we just met normal Iraqi people. I got to stay one night in Jumeirah district, the poorest district in Basra. Went to Abu Ghraib prison when the prisoners were granted amnesty. The final thing that we did before I left, we met with this cultural group called Beit al-Iraqi, and it's just a group of, not necessarily intellectuals, but just people like to sit around and talk about politics and stuff. And it was a really interesting experience. The main thing that we kept being told over and over is just let your government take care of your government and let us take care of our government. Don't be trying to force democracy on the rest of the world when you don't even have a true democracy. One thing that we don't do is we do not ask Iraqi people about how they feel about the Iraqi government, because if we did, that could get them in a lot of trouble if anyone overheard that. So we don't ask about that. We feel our job, being from the United States, is to speak out against anything the United States is doing. The question has been raised in meetings with like Tariq Aziz and stuff about the human rights situation, but with normal Iraqis, we don't bring it up. They're against the Bush policies, and they're just not happy with another war, so I don't think there's going to be the same support for the U.S. And also, the people there, a lot of people have guns, and no matter how they feel about the Iraqi government, whether they support them or whether they don't, which I think there's probably a percentage that don't, but either way, they're not going to allow foreign invaders to come in and come into their home. I figured that the people there are going to be friendly. It's like a thing I've always heard, but it surprised me about how friendly they were after 12 years of sanctions, 20 years of war, that they could be that friendly. There's restaurants that we frequented that we got to know the people there. We always tried to make huge tips just to help them out. The 2,000 Iraqi dinar equals one U.S. dollar, and so like a falafel sandwich is about 150 dinar, so we'd give them about 750 sometimes, just to try to help them out as much as possible.
Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley is launching an investigation into the Pentagon involvement in domestic surveillance and law enforcement by way of the Total Information Awareness Project, headed by disgraced Admiral John Poindexter at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Grassley discussed his concerns today with Robert Knight on Pacifica Station WBAI's Wake Up Call and suggested the possibility of a new left-right coalition to reverse the current round of repressive legislation that encroaches on Americans' privacy and civil liberties.
I would like to know where the Department of Defense gets the statutory authorization for the Total Awareness Program. I want to know what the parameters and scopes are of the program, and how is it being funded? I'm chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. It seems to me we ought to know how it's being funded. I'm very interested in how Admiral Poindexter was selected to head it, whether it was done as part of the awarding of a consulting contract, which I think it was. I want the parts of that contract to be reviewed. And then, lastly, how's this program coordinating with federal law enforcement? Because that's very important. They're the ones that are going to do it. And then, lastly, the extent to which civil liberties are going to be protected.
Does this violate the concept of posse comitatus? Are you concerned about that? Can you explain what it is and why there would be a separation between law enforcement and military?
Yeah, posse comitatus is a old law on the books, and I think it dates back to about post-Civil War time when Congress wanted to make sure that federal Department of Defense was not involved in any local law enforcement. And the reasons are quite obvious. Number one, defense people aren't trained in law enforcement. Number two, military is intended to get the job done at all costs, which shows a disregard for constitutional rights. And lastly, I think we just feel with that law that we ought to have our Department of Defense, our military people, spend all their time in what they're trained to do, and that is the national defense of our country. So there has been for 100 years a clear separation between the Department of Defense and law enforcement, domestic law enforcement. And I want to make sure that this is not violating posse comitatus. And the concern there would be maybe a lack of respect for civil rights, but the extent to which total information awareness is getting involved in law enforcement, it could be a violation of posse comitatus. I don't want to say right at this point it is, but it seems to me that is an important consideration. But more important would be the extent to which the Department of Defense is getting involved in this without discussion with, even discussion as far as I know, that they haven't had with the Department of Justice and FBI.
Are you concerned with the discrepancy between the statement of a Defense Department spokesperson that the budget for total information awareness was $10 million, when in fact documents from DARPA itself indicate an allocation of at least $250 million?
Well, obviously, there's a great deal of difference between $10 million and $250 million, and not just simply from the standpoint of being candid with people, but we need to know what's being put into this, particularly at a time when we may be going to war with Iraq. Regardless, we got the war on terrorism. We got some peacekeeping expeditions around the world, and we ought to know that our defense money is being used for national defense. And for sure, there's something that the Department of Defense ought to be doing to help FBI and the Department of Justice on domestic terrorism and domestic law enforcement, it seems to me it ought to be more transparent. It ought to be open. How much it costs, who's involved with it, and most importantly, having the FBI involved in it. In the middle, so that there is no violation of posse comitatus.
By what authority will you pursue this investigation? Will you petition the Inspector General of the Department of Defense? How mechanically will you accomplish this?
Yeah, I've already made that petition through a letter to Joseph E. Schmidt, and he is the Inspector General, and by golly, a pretty good Inspector General, one of the few having the support of the Secretary of Defense that I've seen where they really wanted to be independent from bureaucracy and sort out wrongdoing. So I think we got a good process for doing it. And I do it from the standpoint of my general responsibilities as chairman of this committee, but more importantly, even more general responsibilities that every senator has of making sure that the laws are faithfully executed according to congressional intent is what we call congressional oversight.
Senator, the issue of Total Information Awareness Project came up at least tangentially in the debate, vote, and discussion of the Homeland Security Act that was passed and signed on Monday by the president. By tangentially, I mean this. There was a concept within the latest incarnation of the legislation that envisioned a Homeland Security Advanced Research Projects Agency, which alarmed a number of people, thinking that would mean total information awareness syndrome. There was another tangential connection in that the Total Information Awareness Project had consultations with the Transportation Safety Administration, which would be part of the Homeland Security Department. Are you concerned that the same issues that you raised might also be embedded in the recently passed Homeland Security legislation?
The answer is yes, and it could be very well that Total Information Awareness at the Department of Defense is a predecessor as far as information is concerned, and as far as tools of law enforcement or information gathering are concerned, to what the Homeland Security might be doing. And so you would have those very same concerns.
Senator, I would be remiss if I did not ask you, what was your reasoning for voting in favor of the Homeland Security Act?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say to you that I'm not 100% sold on the fact that you take 26 different agencies that are involved in law enforcement and put them under one umbrella, that they're necessarily going to deliver the security that's promised. On the other hand, I do know that there's a great deal of turf battle within the United States from one agency to another involved in law enforcement and anything else you might want to think about. And sometimes that turf protection, where one agency is jealous of another, keeps agencies from cooperating the way they should. We've seen the lack of information sharing between the CIA and the FBI as an example of that. And I guess what sold me finally on Homeland Security, being a new department, was that if you put these all under one department head, there ought to be a little less turf protection and turf warfare between agencies that ought to be headed in the same direction, which right now is obviously to help us win the war on terrorism, the domestic war on terrorism, which requires the sort of cooperation that all these 22 agencies ought to have.
Senator Charles Grassley, you are taking on a very bold and an important mission, I think, in challenging the Pentagon's involvement in domestic surveillance and law enforcement. But I'm wondering if we are at a groundbreaking moment in political history in the United States, because a number of people from the progressive and left side of the spectrum are quite concerned about civil liberties here, and quite a number of people from what would be called the conservative or the right side are concerned about constitutional breaches and Bill of Rights issues as well. Is there a common ground that could significantly rein in the excesses that are apparently underway? Is there a coalition that is possible here?
Absolutely. And it rarely gets together, because on some things there's a wide difference between conservatives and liberals on some things. But the best example of people getting together on this is the fact that outgoing Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia, who is probably one of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives, he was defeated in a Republican primary because of reapportioning together with another colleague. He is going to be working for the American Civil Liberties Union on some of these constitutional issues of privacy. And for those, I mean, it's almost like, the devil working with God on something.
Senator Charles Grassley is a Republican from Iowa. He was interviewed on WBAI by Peace Watch Associate Producer Robert Knight. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll meet residents of Southern California with a personal stake in the impending war and a fresh perspective on nonviolence.